better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining her do.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. And you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got to do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a bigger pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. How you doing this evening? Hope you've had a great weekend and enjoyed at least one local farmer's market. A few weeks ago, chef and writer and cookbook author Deborah Madison visited Sonoma County while she was on tour for her new book, Vegetable Literacy, a refreshingly intelligent and uniquely personal look at the foods we grow and cook. The new shed in Healdsburg hosted an event for her, a conversation with me, followed by a tasting and a book signing that featured both her new book and mine, Vinaigrettes and Other Dressings. This was the very first event hosted by Shed, and there were a few stumbles, especially with the sound system. We've done our best editing out the noise, but there will be a lot of background noise because the conversation took place with a live audience, and you know that sort of thing's really unavoidable. Before we get to my conversation with Deborah, I'd like to talk just a bit about Shed. It's unique. It's a combination cafe, coffee bar, fermentation bar, houseware's farm and garden store, pantry, and larder. There's fresh produce for sale, bulk seeds, cooking supplies, specialty items, including that fabulous vinegar, Vinaigre de Bagnols, which has been impossible to find locally since Traverso's closed. It's a larder, too. It's also a community gathering place. They screen movies, host dinners, lectures, and a wide range of other events. And it's also seeking to be a center of learning with workshops on gardening, beekeeping, farming, food crafts, sustainable practices, and more. And it's all in one super sleek modern urban building with open-air patios, beautiful views, and great spaces to linger. And it's right across the street from the Healdsburg Farmers Market. It's located at 25 North Street, and it's been open about 3 months. It's going to be really interesting to see how its first few weeks and months unfold. I suggest a visit and, you know, tell us what you think on Mouthful's Facebook page. Now, on to Deborah Madison. Deborah is one of the most beloved cookbook authors in America. Her fans adore her. She was the founding chef at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco, and her first book, The Green's Cookbook, quickly became and remains a classic. Her groundbreaking Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone is a tour de force of vegetable cookery, and a new edition with 100 new recipes will be out in a few months. Deborah is married to artist Patrick McFarlane. They live in northern New Mexico with their labradoodle, Dante. And now, my April 20th conversation with Deborah Madison about her new book, Vegetable Literacy.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Shed. My name is Cindy Daniel, and I am one of the founders and owners of Shed, along with my husband, Douglas Lipton. And for those of you who don't know about Shed, or this is your first time here, we are downstairs, a cafe, a fermentation bar, a coffee bar, and a marketplace. And upstairs, we call this room the Grange, and it is a space where we intend to hold all kinds of events, cultural, educational, and social events. For a list of what's coming up, go to our website, healdsburgshed.com, but just for a little taste, we do have next week a film on bees, a beekeeping class, and we have a sold-out dinner on Sunday following with the Berniers. And we also have Deborah Coons Garcia's new documentary, Symphony of the Soil, on May 4th. So that's just, we're getting started really fast. So you may know also that we've just opened on Tuesday, and it's a little bit crazy. This is our first Shed event. We've had a couple of community events before we even opened, utilizing the space, but this is our first Shed Talk. And we are really so pleased and honored to welcome Deborah Madison here for this talk. Her new book, Vegetable Literacy, is beautiful and inspiring and brings together what we want Shed to convey: joy in the garden, improvisation in the kitchen, a simple approach to cooking, and delicious eating. Deborah herself embodies many of the values that we share: a keen curiosity to learn, an eye for observation, and excitement for making new discoveries. Clearly in her book, we see that. She's written numerous books and is known for her simple, seasonal, vegetable-based cooking. Deborah got her start in the Bay Area at Chez Panisse before opening Greens, and has lived in New Mexico for the last 20 years. In addition to writing, she served on the boards of Slow Food International Biodiversity Committee, the Seed Savers Exchange, and the Southwest Grass-Fed Livestock Alliance. She's actively involved in issues of biodiversity, gardening, and sustainable agriculture. I'm also really pleased to introduce our other very special guest, Sonoma County's own Michelle Anna Jordan, who most of us know from her three lively columns about food and wine in the San Francisco Press-Democrat, and as well as her radio show on Mouthful known as The Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. And KRCB is here today recording this conversation, so I imagine it'll be aired at some point on Mouthful.
Yes, it will.
Michelle's also a prolific writer and has a brand new cookbook called Vinaigrettes and Other Dressings, which speaks to basics but also offers lots of ideas about how to enliven and brighten up food with a delicious dressing. Both Michelle and Deborah are James Beard Award winners, and as it turns out, old friends. Following what I'm sure will be a warm and lively conversation, we'll have tastes from the kitchen. We'll roll this door open, and the chef is preparing some of the recipes from the book, and both Deborah and Michelle will be in the back to sign their books. The books are on sale, and a couple of people may have thought the books were included, and if you didn't pay for it, you can do that later. So thank you so much for coming. Enjoy, and let's welcome these two. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you, Cindy.
Okay, so Deborah, what I wanted you to talk about first is, I love the introduction and the way that you talk about carrots and that moment of inspiration and epiphany that you had that seemed to me to give birth to the concept that led to the book.
Yeah, it was carrots in a way. It was many things that led to the book, but I had grown carrots one summer, and they make a lot of seeds, like all annual or biennial plants do, and the next year they came up and they made blossoms, which they do in their second year. And they're absolutely beautiful umbilifer blossoms. And I had a great ragdoll cat, and he would run up to one and bat it with his paw, you know, and then run away. And it was so much fun having these flowers and watching him with them. And then I'd look at them and I'd see like a big blue wasp making its way across the top. I'd see how they folded their petals in to kind of protect the seeds and make a cache of seeds. And, you know, it was just fun watching them. And I just started thinking, wow, what are they really? You know, what are these carrots? And what are some of the other plants I have that are doing the same thing in its own little way, like cilantro or chervil or fennel or parsley? They're all making the same flowers. They don't necessarily do the same things, but they all make the same umbilifer flowers. So I thought, time to look behind the pretty face, you know, of a vegetable and see what the unifying principle is at work, which of course turns out to be botany and taking a look at plant families. And that's kind of how it began.
And the book is structured by families. Mm-hmm. I think there are 12 families.
I chose 12.
Yeah, you chose.
It's not 12. It's not every. It doesn't cover by any means every edible vegetable there is. But I chose 12 families with members that are familiar to us, but not as family members. Yeah. So like Polygonaceae, the knotweed family, includes rhubarb, sorrel, and buckwheat.
Yeah, knotweed. You know, how many of you know about knotweeds? Have you heard that term before? Most of you? Yeah, that was... It's like, oh, knotweeds, okay.
And they're called knotweeds because the joints, the knee part, polygonaceae, is knees, they're little swollen areas on the stems, and it makes them look like they have knots, you know, in them. But when I looked at the flowers of buckwheat in particular, and also rhubarb, but to a lesser extent, I thought they looked like knotted embroidery. And so there's another interpretation you maybe could add, because not every plant has these nodes, but the flowers do look similar, as they do in all families. They resemble each other, and they look like beautifully knotted pieces of embroidery.
And while we're talking about things here, let's jump ahead. I loved the onions and asparagus. They once in future lilies, I think. So tell people what they are right here, and then that little story about onions and asparagus being moved.
Yeah, so I called this chapter the former lily family, because at one time in the lily family, Liliaceae, we had onions and asparagus and lilies of all kinds. I mean, calicortus lilies, for example, that grow around here were in this family, probably irises. Lots and lots of beautiful, fragrant flowers. And then you get to onions, which are not fragrant in the same way. And onions are also kind of the workhorse vegetable in many respects in our kitchen, whereas asparagus is like the queen of spring. You know, it's a very, very special plant. And I like that they were together because it was so surprising and kind of contradictory. So I checked with a botanist, and he said, you can keep them together if you want. I mean, botanists quarrel and fight over what are families and how these classifications move around anyway. So he says, if you want to keep them together, do. But I decided to at least allude to the fact that it's been broken up.
Would you talk about the different parts of the asparagus that we can see here?
Well, I want to talk about parts in general. I think one of the problems in our supermarket culture is we never see the whole plant. You know, we just see parts and pieces. And I know this is California. This is a very sophisticated group. You probably all have fabulous gardens. But here's asparagus. But it's in different stages. It's gotten very long, this one. And some of them are going on to make seeds, their flowers, which are small. And I'm so happy to see this, and also the cardoons and artichokes and the rhubarb, because we mostly don't know. We just see pieces of things. And part of being, I think, vegetably literate is knowing the whole plant and also knowing what you can eat and what you can't eat. I have to say that because rhubarb leaves are not something you want to eat, but the stalks are. And this is the rhubarb flower. So if you've ever grown sorrel, you probably would see that it looks pretty much the same as that. I'm sorry, what? I don't know. I've never tried. I mean, I don't know if it's poisonous or not. But, you know, rhubarb is a vegetable I'd be careful with.
Yeah, because rhubarb leaves are poisonous.
Yeah, they are. And the stalks are extremely astringent. And I don't think rhubarb was called pie plant until sugar became common, is my guess.
I used to eat stalks of rhubarb when I was this tall, without sugar. My grandfather grew them, and he'd cut up the big leaves, throw them in the compost, and give me the stalks, and I would just stand there and eat them in potpourri. Oh, they're so good.
Some kids really like sour foods. I had a brother who loved sour foods, those Chinese salt plums that... It just makes my mouth pucker to, you know, think about them. But he would much rather eat that than candy.
Now, I want to move on a little bit to having a family, carrots, whatever, your choice, in the kitchen. Because one of the layers of this book is how plants of the same family complement each other, resonate with each other, and work together.
Yeah, they do. And... the carrot family is interesting because, well, you have carrots. This is the umbilical family. It all makes those beautiful crowns of flowers. So you have parsnips. You have carrots. You've got fennel, and then in the herb department, you have celery, and you have celery root. And in the herb department, there's lots of herbs. There's, again, there's parsley, there's fennel, there's caraway and cumin and cilantro and chervil. And all those herbs happen to work pretty well with those vegetables, as it turns out. Which isn't to say they don't work with other vegetables as well. They do. But you don't have to worry too much. If you have a carrot and you put it with dill, it's going to go in one direction, and if you put it with caraway and cumin, it's going to go in another direction. So you have a lot of possibilities within this family. You can feel pretty relaxed about mixing and matching, I think. Other families aren't so obvious, like the knotweed family. I was thinking, what about rhubarb, sorrel, and buckwheat? Well, three really difficult, you know, kinds of plants. And one herb, Vietnamese coriander, is in that, which is like so sweet and so lovely and fragrant and complex. It's completely different than these other plants. But I thought, could you put those together in some way, the three main ones? And I thought, well, yeah, you could do a buckwheat crepe with a rhubarb compote. You could do a buckwheat crepe with some sort of filling, maybe wild mushrooms and a sorrel sauce. You know, buckwheat is a little bit stodgy. The other two vegetables are sharp. They complement each other. But on the other hand, rhubarb is really nice in a compote with angelica, back to another family, back to the umbels. So
that's interesting. That I'd never thought of.
It doesn't, I'm not really writing a book where I'm trying to get things to, like, be matchy-matchy, you know, but more to say that once you understand and know what's related, you can feel very relaxed. You can use things interchangeably. Spinach, chard, beet greens, they're all the same family. Wild spinach goes on and on. Yeah.
What about the nightshade family? It's always been a favorite of mine, probably because I liked the word when I was a little girl. Deadly nightshade just seems so intriguing. But those, I see particularly strong resonance between members of that family. I mean, roasted sweet peppers and tomatoes, for example, are so wonderful. I mean, that's the height of summer in certain ways.
Yeah, I mean, a ratatouille, for example, is a dish of nightshades plus an onion or two. You know, so they do go together. But I was thinking more about other characteristics of nightshades, which is that they're a really difficult family because of alkaloids that are present in them. So wherever they were introduced from one culture to another, it was with great difficulty. In general, I think people have been cautious. Maybe we're not, because we always are hungry for new experience, but you know, people didn't really want to eat the potato at first. The Russian Orthodox Church banned it and said it wasn't mentioned in the Bible. And other people said, why would you eat a food that a dog isn't even interested in? Because dogs aren't interested in potatoes, you know, particularly. Eggplants, which were extremely bitter, more than they are now for a long time, were thought to cause leprosy. We were told tomatoes cause cancer, and Americans wouldn't eat them until...
We did not eat tomatoes.
Yeah,
until a tomato would kill you.
Yeah, a doctor stood up in front of a group like this and ate a tomato, and he didn't die, you know. I mean, there have been real problems associated with them, and this whole family, you know, has dangerous elements in it. It has drugs. It has, like, belladonna,
belladonna.
Which comes from the words beautiful woman, because in medieval times, women thought it looked beautiful to have dilated pupils, which is what belladonna does if you eat enough of it. So, but in small quantities, it's good because that's what the optometrist is essentially doing when he looks into your eyes, you know, and they've been dilated. Not because they're beautiful, but because he can see, you know, so and nicotine is in this family too.
Yeah, that one surprised me that tobacco is in nightshade.
So, It's a family with challenges, but we do love them, and particularly since we've tamed them somewhat. Eggplants used to be ornamentals in English gardens before they were vegetables, because they were just not good to eat. And they're still beautiful ornamentals. I mean, they're gorgeous plants.
Yeah, they're beautiful. Really, really beautiful. As I was reading your book, one of the things I wondered if you explored is, I think we have an intuitive sense of these families in a certain way, certainly not forefront in our, you know, really forward in our mind. But I think there's this element of intuition. Again, taking us back to the seasons, there we have the nightshades growing, and they're the sun lovers, you said. So did you think about that much at all, or did you find that, or am I just out of my mind and I don't, and that's not really there at all?
I didn't think about it at all. Actually, you're probably right. I mean, I think we are pretty smart about vegetables, mm-hmm. But we do get confused because everything's available all the time.
Yes.
You know, so,
yes.
And things aren't arranged in a store according to families at all. I mean, it's just, you know, the rutabagas are down at knee level, you know, where you're
not
going to
see
it if they're there at all. And, you know, something more glamorous is up at eye level with a higher price tag. I mean, they're not grouped according to any botanical sort of grouping.
Yeah.
And not that anybody would know what that would mean anyway, but they might have an intuitive feeling about it.
Yeah, and, you know, the seasonality really has been obliterated in supermarkets. You know, that's just not there anymore. You have to go to the farmers markets for that.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. In season is where you live. That's what I'm convinced.
Yes, in season where you live.
Yeah. There are some relationships, though, that I think we know, but we don't know we know. For example, the brassica genus of the cruciferous plants, cabbages are, well, you know coleslaw, right? And these are called cole crops. And colza is made from a seed in this family. It's a kind of oil. We have kohlrabi. We have collards. We have all these cole words.
Colcannon, even.
Yeah, colcannon is an Irish dish based on cabbage and potatoes. So we have all these words that actually are referring to this root word, col, which I've learned comes from the Latin for stem. So if you go back and look at Ville Morin's illustrated book, you see all the cabbages show these very large stems. We never think about the stems. I mean, we never see the stems. I didn't even know cabbages had stems, you know. But there it is. The stems were very important, and they were one of the signifiers of this group.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
You garden, right?
I try to garden.
And
I am not, this is not a book on how to do it.
No, but I loved the story about when the first thing you grew in that muddy, hard clay.
Oh, yeah.
You were at the San Francisco...
At Green Gulch Farm.
Oh, Green Gulch Farm.
Yeah. I have to preface this by saying my father was a botanist, my brother's a botanist. You know, we have a lot of plant stuff in our family, but it never occurred to me to plant anything. And until I moved to Green Gulch Farm, and I lived in an old cow shed, a bull shed that had been made into a funky, a really funky residence. And the front yard of this place, which was actually fenced in, had housed over a period of time a number of very large Hereford bulls that had trampled on this clay soil for, 20, 30 years. So I looked out and I thought, this is pretty forlorn, you know. We have to do better. Maybe I'll plant something. So I went down to the greenhouse at the farm and talked to Wendy Johnson, who was the head gardener, and she gave me a little sage plant, really tiny sage plant. And I went back and I tried to dig a hole for it, and I couldn't. It was so compacted. So I had to go back to her and borrow a pickaxe and pickaxe a hole for it, plant this plant. And that was my first. And from that moment on, I was hooked. You know, I was thinking, what else can I plant here? And bit by bit, because I didn't have a lot of free time. I was starting greens at that time, and everything had to be pickaxed. But I did make a garden over a period of about 5 years, and it was really fun. Yeah.
And you know that you live in northern New Mexico.
Uh huh.
And how is it gardening in that area?
It's really hard. It's really hard. I mean, it's more of that clay soil, adobe, right, comes from there. It's heavy winds. It's, you know, cold in the winter. It's hot in the summer. You know, freezes come late. It's not much fun. It's not like California. It's an uphill fight kind of all the way. So, you try because it's there, but... It's hard. It's just not like Sonoma County, I have to say.
Nothing's like Sonoma County.
Nothing is.
Let's talk a little bit about cooking. Let's give some cooking advice based on these families and the way you group things together. So for somebody who's never thought about things in this way, I love the little, you do little menus in each chapter, and I love that.
Oh, good.
I love reading menus. I can just sit and read menus. They just can stimulate creativity really well. So what's a really good way for somebody to get started who wants to explore this whole arena?
Well, I mean, again, I think knowing what's related to each other gives you a lot of clues. You might start to see things that you hadn't seen before, notice that you hadn't noticed before. It's not that you have to have a garden, but there's a lot of plants we can eat that are wild, that just grow like weeds. I'm thinking of calipes, wild spinach, or lamb's quarters, related to chard, related to spinach, you know, related to beet greens, to amaranth. There's a big selection of plants here that are rather similar. You know, so we don't have to just limit ourselves to spinach. If you have amaranth, use that.
Yeah, amaranth leaves.
Curious, though, about that grouping. I mean, it's a group that has an herb in it. The herb is epazote, which, as you probably know, is one of the rankest, strongest herbs. People go, ooh, you know, why would you eat that? You know, it's a little bit scary. Everything else is, like, so mild. You know, but not epazote. It's really powerful, which is sort of interesting. However, when you use it, it just fades away, you know, and just leaves this little trace of itself.
Yeah, used in cooking, it's really wonderful. It takes it. It's very mild mannered once you put it into a dish.
It starts out strong and it ends up very tame, you know. But all the leaves you'll find have similar qualities. And if you have a garden, you have chard, say, and it starts to bolt. This is what happened to me. My chard was bolted, and I thought, oh, darn, I should have planted another crop. I really like chard. I'm going to cut these stalks down and hope that it makes more big leaves. The stalks were about that tall. And as they grow, and they want to make seeds, the leaves get further and further apart, and they get smaller and smaller. And I was taking an armload of this to the compost, and I thought, gosh, I wonder if you can eat this, you know. And so I took it back into the kitchen. I pulled off all the leaves. I cut the stems. I cooked them. Yeah, they're delicious. Of course you can eat them. But what was so interesting is they began to take on more the flavor of the wild greens in that family as they bolted and got bigger. So it's just something to notice. Yeah. It's not a recipe, you know, or a suggestion or anything. But again, if you're in contact with a garden, there are many possibilities that we may not have thought of.
Yeah, that's
and the garden tells you all the time what they are.
Absolutely. My sorrel is bolting right now. Tell me, you better make sorrel soup or it's going to be too late.
Yeah, and you won't want it.
Exactly.
Anyway.
You're listening to my April 20th conversation with Deborah Madison at Shed in Healdsburg.
Grapes are covering the grassland. They're buying up for family farms. They're selling out. Who can blame them? Wine's a cash crop growing strong. Soon. on this land once open and free. Well, they got pictures in the museum of local color that used to be.
Now we're moving on to the question and answer period, and I've got to warn you that, unfortunately, I don't repeat every question as I'd planned on doing. That day we were all a little rattled by the challenges of the sound system, and in my efforts to keep the audience entertained, I missed a few beats important for our broadcast of the show. Still, Deborah is so articulate that I think her answers will make full sense even without hearing the question first. And now, here's the second part of our conversation.
I want the audience to have an opportunity to ask questions as well. So let's see if we got somebody eager with something they'd like to ask. The question is about growing peppers in New Mexico and why it works so well.
The people who are growing peppers, I mean, they've been growing them in the same little fields and areas for a long time, generally. I mean, many things do well in New Mexico. I'm not saying that they don't do well. I'm just saying it's hard. It's hard when your soil is cement, you know, to get it to the, it's not nothing like loam. You can't stick your hand in it, you know, and have it come up to your arm and invite seeds. But if someone who's been farming for a while has been working their soil, so they have it. But I'm thinking more of people who aren't farmers, people who are just people, with other kinds of jobs and careers, who maybe want to start a garden, they want their kids to have an experience. Well, you want them to succeed, you know. It's important to have a success, or you think, why is my back hurting so much, and is it really worth it? I can go to the farmer's market and buy this. But many people feel it is, so maybe they use a bed or something to...
Yeah, raised bed anywhere. And I always say, start with radish seeds.
Yeah, there's some things
they
that
grow
are
really fast. I grew them as a little girl, and I fell in love with the soil when I saw these little radishes, you know, just perk their little heads up, and you could eat them 3 weeks later.
Oh, that's an interesting question. I was really frustrated and have been for a long time, for example, that our farmers never tell you what you're getting. You know, they have lettuce, but they won't say it's limestone or it's bib or it's Marvel of Four Seasons. And so people are buying this food. Oh, it was my fruit book. And they're clueless about it. And with fruit, it's really important because a lot of fruit comes on trees and shrubs, and they're not annuals. It takes a long time. And if we don't know what something is called, we can't build a relationship to it and ask for it again. And that's how foods disappear from our culture. And when I talk to farmers about this in our market, they're very protective, and they say, oh, no, I'm not putting the name on because that farmer down there, he's going to see what I'm growing, and he's going to grow it too. I want to be the only one. You know, so it's a little discouraging. There are markets, actually like in Arlington, Mass., where everybody labels everything. If there's a lot of apple growers, they have the same thing. It says Portland apple. It tells you something about it. Is it an heirloom? What do you use it for? What is it like? I mean, New Mex chilies, Joe Parker, everything, every variety is labeled. And no one's squabbling, you know. So it was this, I think, desire to try to get us smarter about the foods we're eating so that we really keep our food culture that's emerging and that it's not a fad. And part of that was what vegetable literacy is about, which is plant families, relationships, how things behave, eating the whole plant, not just the parts and pieces you see in the store. It's not about gardening or saying you should garden, but if you take a farm tour or you're in this beautiful place and you see this asparagus going, you might just ask about it. Ask yourself a question about it. So,
yes, you had a question.
Well, it's interesting what you say about artichokes, because the stems have always been there, right? And now people are figuring out, partly because they travel to Italy, that you can eat the stems, and now Ocean Mist is selling artichokes with like 8 inches of stems, for which you pay an extra dollar an artichoke. How they ate artichokes in the first place, I don't know, but that's another story. I don't know that it was courage necessarily, but gosh, you just have this in front of you. It's, why not give it a try and see? I mean, some things you might spit out, but mostly you don't. Like radish leaves. I noticed they're the same shape as arugula leaves, as kohlrabi leaves, as all these leaves in that family. And then I just asked the question, how do they taste? I bet they'd be good. They're fine. You know, so they make a great soup. They're good in a salad. You can sliver them and mix them with radishes and butter. You know, you can do all kinds of things with them. It was just a kind of, I wonder what you could do with that kind of feeling. And I know there are people who can take this much further than I did in this book. You know, but a lot of things are stuff we get from the supermarket. It's the broccoli stems, the cauliflower cores, the radish greens, you know, the charred stems. It's some of these things we do actually see, whether, you know, quite easily and quite frequently.
Yeah, somebody at our farmer's market in Sebastopol 2 weeks ago was selling radish leaves. Just, they had this huge basket of radish leaves, $3 a pound. You can make a lot of soup with half a pound of radish leaves. He was making money off a disaster. He planted all his radishes too close together, so the bulbs weren't forming. He had to thin them out. He's like, these are great greens. I'll see what happens.
Actually, one of our farmers was selling broccoli greens last year, and he called them broccoli kale, which isn't really anything. You know? But he knew that people knew kale, so that if they saw the broccoli greens, they could make that leap, and they did. And then he cooked up some fried onions, and he shredded the greens, and they're delicious, you know. So he said, you know, usually we just toss these on the path. But why not sell them? So, and another farmer at our market said, try this. What do you think it is? I had no idea. Fava leaves. Delicious. You know, I had a fava plant yesterday that was, I'm afraid to move this, but it was about 5 feet long. It had big beans on it. It had tiny beans on it. And the night before we had eaten in a restaurant where they serve those tiny, tiny pods with the beans in them, not even shucked. You know, they're quite edible and delicious. The leaves are delicious. We have a lot of material available to us.
Yeah, it's so much more than just that radish that you can buy, you know, a handful of radishes. There's so much more to that,
yeah.
And with everything. One topic I saved almost until last, because I think it's so intriguing, the grasses. People don't think, I don't think, of the grains that we eat necessarily as grasses.
No, probably not. Do you? Anybody? Yeah, some of you do. But they are grasses. They're in the grass family, Poaceae, and so is bamboo. Corn is a grass. Wheat, of course, and barley and rye, and all of these things are grasses, and we're eating their seeds. We also eat the seeds of buckwheat, quinoa, and amaranth, but they're not grasses, so they're called pseudograins. They're just pretend grains, right? But we're still eating the seeds. What separates the grasses from those plants is that one is they're monocots. They just send up one primary leaf rather than two. And all the veins in the leaves run vertically rather than horizontally, which I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. You know, so you can identify them. But we're still eating seeds, you know, whether it's wheat or whether it's amaranth.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the grasses are very old plants. I love the way they, these things come up. Like, well, onion isn't a grass, but it's, you know, it's one of these simpler plants. And when it comes, when a leek comes out of the earth, it's like a leg that's extending itself instead of like radishes make two little round leaves. They're very cute, and then something else comes up. But these look like these legs coming out of the ground that stretch and open up.
Oh, that's just such a great image.
They're sort of amazing. It's like planting hair, but, you know, they're not my favorite things to grow.
The flowers are pretty amazing, too, and they have leek flowers. Mm-hmm. I made the mistake once. All of my leeks went made flowers. They're so beautiful, and I picked a huge bouquet, and I had this huge urn at the head of my bed, behind my bed, and I put them there and didn't think about it, and I went to bed. I thought I was going to die, tears streaming down my cheeks. I had to get up and, of course, move the leek flowers out of my bedroom and out of the house.
I did exactly the same thing with society garlic. Oh. And because it's such a pretty flower, you know, these glaucous gray stems and the pink blossoms, and I had a bunch, and I put them in my apartment house foyer in San Francisco. Oh, I saw somebody come by, just pick them up and throw them out. I mean, it really made everything smell like garlic. So society garlic is not really permission to eat it before you go to a meeting. You know, it's strong stuff.
Yeah, it is. It is. Any more questions? And you'll have... Okay, great.
Oh, bit by bit. You know, I mean, a lot of it is lonely and sitting home and writing, you know. You know, I fortunately have the garden, which I wander out into anyway. So, you know, there's a balance that you have to find between being utterly alone and isolated in your room, between cooking, which is very gratifying, or going out and gardening, doing something with your hands. So that's always a challenge. You have time enough to find a photographer and maybe talk about what you want to do. These photographers came out. We worked together for 5 or 6 days. I cooked all the food. They took the pictures. We traveled to a farm. We used my garden. You know, it just all happens kind of bit by bit. You know, there's a lot of overlapping of activity.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden it's a book.
But it's bit by bit. When you get it.
Yeah. Oh, there's another question. Oh, great.
You know, it's hard to say because it's something I was thinking about for many years. But then it took about a year and a half, which is, for me, too fast. It's a little too fast. But I'd been taking notes. I'd been just mulling it over for quite a long time.
Okay, before we break to go buy books and eat, I want to talk about what's next for you. I know that you've been working on... I think it's a revised edition of Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone.
Yeah, that's true. It's going to come out this fall. And it's going to look totally different. It's going to have more different recipes, 100 new recipes or more. And but your old favorites will be there too. Yeah.
And then after that, you're going to rest? Or do you know what you're going to work on next?
I have some ideas I can't talk about.
Yeah, I understand that, yes. Absolutely.
They're truly babies. Uh-huh. And I don't know when. I just need to stop for a while.
Yeah. 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 Now, back to the writing part of it. You have a dog now.
Yes,
and
I
is
do.
That new, Dante?
Dante is he's my baby. He's my little labradoodle. And once I rearranged my life in order to stay home to be able to garden, I finally realized I could get a dog and a puppy, furthermore, which was quite a handful. So, yeah, and there's some advantages to staying home.
Yeah. Does he hang out in the room with you when you're writing?
Oh, he's in and out. Okay. I can't wait till summer and the doors are all open and he can go wherever he wants. Oh. But he sometimes does.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's what, he's good company.
Yeah, I spend most of my time alone in writing, and I have my first two dogs now, my first puppy ever, and they stay in the room where I'm writing. They like to be near where I am.
They do. They like to lay down, but then you have to scratch their tummies so often.
In fact, one day I wasn't going into my room, my office, and sitting down immediately. And Joey, who's the older little dachshund, he's looking at me, and he finally starts trying to herd me into the office. Sit down, right. We want our days to be like they always are.
I'm glad my dog's not that smart. Yeah, Charles. Yeah. In this book, I did. I had to, because I'm not a botanist. You know, I have lots of botany books. I have books on plants. I'm no botanist. So, yeah, I did a lot of reading, research, talking to people, visiting with botanists. It was really interesting. No. I mean, I have to make myself do it. I like to just sit and write more than anything. But no, because I needed to hear what they had to say. It was actually fun. It made my world get a little bigger.
Did you find that the people that you talked to, the botanists and that sort of thing, were they amenable to this concept you were working with? Did they get it right away and think, wow, cool?
Yeah, I mean, the ones I chose to talk to liked it. Of course, you know, and they also gave it critical reads, like, you can't put that in there, that's not in there, or, you know, these are different genus, you have to explain that. I said, no, I don't have to explain it. This isn't a botany book. It's only in the broadest sense, mm-hmm. but still there's a lot you can get wrong, mm-hmm. so it has to get right.
What was the most challenging part of this book?
Recipes. Because I just like to cook, yeah. you know, and it's very hard for me sometimes to do measurements and I'm writing recipes, and I want them to work for everybody, but maybe I'm using some weird green from my garden, you know, that isn't the same family, but nonetheless, you know, you have to do it the other way, too. Mm-hmm. So, but that's okay. I mean, I'm going to cook anyway, so, you know, but I really did get into this other kid.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's a whole different thing than if you just cook, then you have to have the left brain person sitting there observing measurements and everything and making you write them down.
It's just a different process. I mean, I like the recipes, and mm-hmm. there are lots of them, and I think that they're good. But they really do reflect particular vegetables and families. So they're not particularly complicated. They're more straightforward mm-hmm. from the garden.
Yeah. Any more questions? Yes. Yes. Rhubarb leaves.
Well, I did put it in my book, but there's lots of reference books on vegetables and stuff, or you can, or look it up, or go online and look up rhubarb. And
yeah, look up.
I'm
yeah.
sure everybody will tell you do not eat the leaves. Or Wikipedia has a very good botanical mm-hmm. section. I would be slightly cautious about just eating anything. I mean, actually, I eat just about anything. But for example, poison hemlock looks a whole lot like OSHA root, like fennel, like lovage, and you can do yourself some harm. So I wouldn't just go gadding about with things where there's a real poisonous member without knowing.
Yeah, it's like with mushrooms. You really need to know, because a lot of harmful mushrooms will resemble mushrooms that are perfectly fine. And, you know, if you find yourself in a real pinch and you need to know, you can always call the Poison Center hotline. I know that because I accidentally squirted Serrano in my eye and didn't know what to do, and it was the Poison Center that knew exactly what to do. And so they're a resource if nothing else pans out.
But be careful, Rebecca.
Well, I think it's probably time to move over to the book signing. So there's going to be a lot of people who want your signature and who want to buy books. And if you're in line and it's taking a long time, you can come over and talk to me. So you don't have to buy my book. You can certainly pass the time with me. And at some point, we will have tastes from Deborah's book as well. You guys have been a great audience. Thank you so much. Congratulations to Cindy for the first public event. And again, Deborah, thank you, and congratulations on your wonderful new book, Vegetable Literacy. I just want to say the title over and over.
Thank you, Michelle.
You bet.
Cindy, you too.
That's my conversation with Deborah Madison at Shed on April 20th. The new book is really remarkable. Take a look at it. It's available wherever books are sold. And you know me, I always say, check your local bookstore before you go online. You want your neighbors, including those who sell books, to stay healthy and viable. So they're there next time you want to walk in. Thanks for sticking with us throughout the hour, and be sure to tune in next week for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour here on KRCB.
Children, it is plain but true. God knows if a preacher preaches long enough.
Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour, is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan, who also selects Mouthful's music. Live episodes are engineered by Michael Young and occasionally by Mary Moore Campagna. Mark Fuller is Mouthful's recording and post-production engineer. Podcasts are available at iTunes and krcb.org. For more information, to suggest a guest, and to find out how to be a guest yourself, email catsmilk@sonic.net or send a message via Mouthful's Facebook page.
To the Lord, let praises be. It's time for dinner now. I'm looking back.